What's up, everybody, and welcome to episode number 133 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host Ray, aka All Day Ray, aka Wally Balls, and I'm joined here by my co-host, former market maker of 20 years and current day trading educator, the man who's run more promotions than a Vegas fight night, the Gorilla of House Street, JJ. How's it going?
What's up, brother? How you doing?
I'm doing very good. And our guest today, he's making his second appearance on the pod. He is the CEO of Bitwise Asset Management, formerly product manager at Facebook and Instagram, Wharton graduate, and Forbes 30 Under 30 selection. Of course, I'm talking about Hunter Horsley. Hunter, how's it going, man? Thanks for joining us again.
You can call me All Day Hunter.
All Day Hunter.
Hunter.
Back
It's
on the
great to
pod.
be back with the two of you. I think last time we chatted was it the first half of 2024? I can't quite remember the
It
exact
was
date. It's right when you fired up.
right during the ETF, the day of the ETF launch.
Oh, wow.
Yes,
That was
it was
cool.
that morning. Yeah.
That was super
Wow.
cool.
That was
And
super cool.
you're in fact the reason why I jumped into Bitcoin. I'm,
Is that right, JJ?
Gen X late adopter. 57, and I just buy a little bit when it dips and put it away and forget about it.
JJ, you
Yep.
owe me big.
I owe you big
I'm
time.
the reason you got into Bitcoin. That's great. I
Yeah, because
love to hear that, and love that love that you built an exposure. I think that's
yeah.
awesome.
Well, you cleared up the clearing and settlement, and I'm a clearing, settlement, and compliance guy because I was always trying to find a way around it. So you cleared that up for me, and I'm like, oh, done. I'm in.
Awesome. Awesome. That's so great.
You know, Hunter,
I
I
was
was
sorry.
sorry. Yeah, I no, I was gonna say we had Jeff Park
Yep.
on last month. Super smart guy. I
Oh
love
my
Jeff. I love
God.
following his stuff. But I was joking with him because he mentioned this on the pod that you were the reason why he got into BTC. But it's not all the years I've been hounding him
No,
to get on it. It
no.
was you, Hunter. So you
Yep.
know, I couldn't
I'm
get through to
honored. I'm honestly honored. You two are brilliant, and so love to hear that. That's really, really fun. Thanks for sharing that.
Cool, man. Well, yeah, we love you guys at Bitwise, man, and what you guys are doing.
Thank you.
Hunter, yeah, I'm just curious, you know, since you know we had you on that ETF launch day, how's Bitwise evolved and grown since ETF approval?
I think that we're maybe 10x larger or
Wow.
thereabouts as a firm. So we manage north of 12 billion in client assets today. Probably at the time that the Bitcoin ETF launched, it was closer to a billion and a half or something like that. The number is now higher than 12. We just haven't published the most recent number. We do a lot more things than the last time we spoke. So the app, so what many people know Bitwise for is ETPs. We manage one of the largest Bitcoin ETPs in the US. BITB, the Bitwise Bitcoin ETP, is about 5 billion or thereabouts now. We have one of the largest in Europe. It's about 1.5 billion. That's BTCE. Some people know our index fund, the Bitwise 10 Crypto Index Fund. That's the largest crypto index fund in the world. It's about 1.5 billion or a little north of that. So many people know us for the ETPs. What less people know is that we also manage alpha strategies and custom solutions, which Jeff helps lead at Bitwise. Those are option strategies to generate yield on Bitcoin. So some of our clients, they already own 8 figures of Bitcoin or 9 figures of Bitcoin, and they want to generate income from that. And we can implement a variety of different strategies to help do that. They can keep their Bitcoin in cold storage. We have a multi-strategy hedge fund and a few other things there. We can do some custom things. And then we also are a staking operator. So we have clients who hold Ethereum, say, and they want to participate in the yield that's possible from staking. And we have a part of the business that it's not funds or securities, it's data center provisioning and software, whereby they can affect staking those assets. And so the way that those three parts of the business, so sort of staking solutions, alpha and custom solutions, and ETPs all interrelate is that we aspire that somebody can work with Bitwise. There's 110 people here now. That's also up from the last time we spoke, and can feel that they're bolting on a lot of leverage, by having a relationship with the firm, and then that we can help them get the exposure they want or run the strategy they want, accomplish what they want in this space. So that, most dimensions of that have just matured since the last time we spoke. The amount of assets that we serve now, of course, has grown meaningfully. I think we're the fourth largest in the world behind BlackRock's, BlackRock with their Bitcoin ETF, Fidelity with their Bitcoin ETF, Grayscale with their Bitcoin ETF, and then Bitwise, we do a lot more than a Bitcoin ETF. But and then the world around us has also changed a lot as well.
For sure. Dude, that's sweet, man. 10x growth. I imagine it's going to continue to grow. This is just a start. That's awesome. You mentioned Ethereum yield and stuff, and obviously I think that's like kind of like a hot thing right now. I've been seeing recently is people shifting treasury moves beyond Bitcoin. So just, for the listeners, like why would companies start choosing Ethereum now to start adding to the treasuries?
Oh, there's a lot of reasons. Something that is fun about Bitwise is that Bitwise exists to help investors who are usually really smart, sometimes a little short on time, understand the landscape of opportunities, and then participate in the ones they want to. Which means every time this space changes, it could have been ICOs in 2017, 2018, the introduction of DeFi in 2019. The emergence of additional L1s over time, the change of market structure, the ability to generate yield with the introduction of options. Now we have these treasury companies. Bitwise is sort of like alongside the investor, trying to make sense of it all and figure out what exposures are interesting and how to take them. The advantage we have is just 110 people who do it full time, and so we can provide leverage into investors. But we basically have the same vantage point on all this stuff as Ray or UJJ or any other investor. So my lens on this currently, there's obviously a huge development with Bitcoin treasury companies, led by MicroStrategy, which is a Goliath. And there's now, I believe, over 100, I want to say 120, companies that own public companies that own Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And in Q2, that increased by over 50%, and they own almost 4% of all the Bitcoin. And they increased the amount of Bitcoin they own by over 20% in just Q2. We're talking about a quarter. So 50% more companies buying Bitcoin, and the amount of Bitcoin they bought was over a 20% increase over the first quarter, and the tonnage is pretty serious. So I think as a byproduct of that, there are people who have conviction on other assets like Ethereum, and they say, why doesn't this make sense for those assets too? And so now we're seeing, I think there's three or four Ethereum treasury companies, the Ether Machine, there's Bitmine Immersion, where Tom Lee is the chairman, there's SBET. We're actually a really senior executive from BlackRock just joined as co-CEO today, Joseph Chalom. And there are others in the works, and we're going to see this probably for Solana and a few other assets too, where people say, the journey with Bitcoin treasuries is now really maturing, and is it serious scale? Can we do this with these other assets? Of course, there's some differences. I think Saylor says that if you want to build a skyscraper-like strategy, you have to use iron, and Bitcoin is iron. And I believe he said Ethereum is like building a skyscraper with balsa wood, so it does not have a favorable view on the merits of that. But of course, there's a lot of different views in crypto. That's why it's a market and a volatile space. On Ethereum, so anyways, yeah, we have the first sort of set of forays on Ethereum, and soon a few others, I think it's incredibly fascinating. I think in a way, and I'm sorry for giving you the longest winded take in the world on this, but I'll land the plane in a second here. But I was listening to Tom Lee, who's involved with the chairman of Bitmine Immersion, in an interview yesterday or the day before. And he said, we announced what we were doing, I want to say 16 days ago, 20 days ago. And fast forward to today, Bitmine Immersion is a $2.5 billion company, so it's a publicly traded small cap, and has a run rate net income of $100 million. And I thought that that was so fascinating because when you talk to an investor, maybe friends or other traders or allocators, JJ and Ray, sometimes they'll say, why should I buy, how do you think about the value of Bitcoin? How much could it be worth? Or how should I think about the value of Ethereum? And with Bitcoin, there's some conversation about supply and demand, and it's a scarce asset. It's kind of like gold. And sometimes the remark you'll hear is, well, there's no revenue. It's just supply and demand. And you say, yeah, that's sort of the story there. And then they say, well, what about Ethereum? What's the story in Ethereum? And then sometimes people say, well, there are applications and that causes transaction fees, and in turn those get burned. It's almost like a buyback, and then you can stake and earn a yield. Okay, so you take that conversation, which is a conversation that has existed in this space for a long time, which is how should I think about valuation and value accrual? But then when you load it into these public equities, it kind of gets abstracted up. So what is the value of a Bitcoin treasury company? It's the value of the Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And the Bitcoin on the balance sheet is going to be dependent on supply and demand. What's the value of the Ethereum treasury company? The fascinating thing that Tom Lee's interview hints at is it's a simplification of that Ethereum story. It's the value of the Ethereum on the balance sheet, but it also has a staking yield. So it's also that Ethereum treasury company has net income. It has an income stream from staking. And so it'll be really interesting because in the eyes of the busy, not week to week following crypto, not following the Petra upgrade or staking versus mining, there's two simple stories there. There's two equities. They both hold a digital asset on the balance sheet. One of them is Bitcoin, this Goliath. The other one is Ethereum, this up and comer. And this one has $100 million run rate net income at a $2.5 billion market cap. And this one has primarily the realized and unrealized gains and losses on the asset on the balance sheet. And I could see these treasury companies ultimately simplifying the stories around different assets and translating them into terms that equity investors are familiar with. And so I think it's through that lens also quite fascinating. But I think we're sort of in the early stages of the category writ large, and certainly of assets outside of Bitcoin.
Very, very fascinating. And yeah, I was going to ask you this, like around Ethereum, specifically, if, people are looking at it, as just like a directional player. People are now becoming more interested in staking and yield generating with ETH for the treasury. So is that, are people coming around to that idea, or that's what it sounds like?
Yeah, I think for all of the treasury companies, from Bitcoin to Ethereum or anything else, yield is going to be the conversation. How much Bitcoin do you have? But then how are you growing your asset base? And so I think every treasury company that holds an asset that can be staked is going to stake it. And I think the Bitcoin, we work with some of the treasury companies as I mentioned earlier, we have clients who own spot assets, and they ask us to implement staking or options overlays. Well, treasury companies are now owners of spot assets, and so we're working with two already, and or excuse me, three as of this week. And we're talking with others about how can we help them generate yield on their balance sheet, either through option strategies or staking, or there's a few other things you can do. So I think yield is going to be the topic increasingly for these treasury companies. I think there's one other topic that's going to come into play as well.
Yeah, go ahead. While we're on it, do you want to mention it?
Yeah, I think some of them are going to aspire to sort of Berkshire Hathaway of the assets ecosystem and are going to buy operating businesses that are involved in the ecosystem. So if it's a Bitcoin treasury company, maybe they'll buy a Bitcoin payments solution, a Bitcoin media or conference business, or some other businesses. If it's an Ethereum company, similarly, I think that they Not every treasury company, I think, is going to take this view, but I think some of them will say we're going to build or buy operating businesses that generate revenues from this asset that we have conviction on, in addition to just acquiring more of it through capital markets activities and generating yield on it.
That's
There's a
like
third, there's another, oh,
that's
sorry, go ahead.
very
Yeah,
cool.
JJ,
Sorry,
please.
that's very cool. That whole Berkshire Hathaway sort of business model, but applied to this asset class, which is, and why not? It's like, yeah, this is so cool. Sorry, go ahead. Sorry, I always learn something, at least three or four things every time you guys come on. Jeff was scary smart. Like, oh my God, that dude is like, I went to university with guys like that, and they were like, could you imagine going to work with people like that and being around in an environment where you have three or four people like that, the creative things that you could come up with? It's just mind-boggling. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, totally. Well, love you saying that. I think Jeff is brilliant, and there's a lot of brilliant people at Bitwise, and there's a lot of brilliant people, as you guys probably experience every day, who are joining the industry to work full time and exert their professional talents towards the space. So Bitwise is 110 of them, and it is really, really fun because the space presents so many new questions and things to contemplate and understand. And then if you have a really talented team, you get to sort of solve puzzles and make sense of it all. And there's definitely just no shortage of things to contemplate and then ultimately do for clients.
Now, if
I
we
think,
could only get them to the regulators to get some smart people over there.
yeah,
And I think you know
there's
what
a,
I'm talking about. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I saw the news 2 days ago. I'm not going to say more, but we
Yeah,
need that
right.
kind of intelligence with the
Yeah.
regulatory so they can understand, because it's obvious they don't understand the business. And it's not, I mean, I didn't until you guys explained it to me, and I've been in the markets for 33 years, so.
I think that the great thing that's happening on the regulatory front is one has to keep in mind with regulators that these are also humans, and I don't know what your guys' Friday evening plans are, but they have Friday evening plans too.
That's true.
They're not like trying to be the villain. I mean, maybe there's a few of them who have these grandstanding agendas for the way they want to express influence into the world. But most of them just want to do a good job. They want their colleagues to like them. They want the people that they interact with professionally to like them. They want to do good work. They want to go do their Friday evening plans. They want their friends and families to like them. And I think it can't be overstated how much the agenda comes from the chair and from the person who's put in charge of the agency. And then the people at the agency, it is their job and their responsibility to pursue the agenda. So what I see, I mean, we've now been around for 7 years. We've worked with regulators consistently throughout. So that's, in the context of the SEC, that was under Jay Clayton, and then we've been here for Gary Gensler. Now we're here for Paul Atkins, and Ueda in the interim. And I think what is incredibly palatable, we were just some of my colleagues were in with the SEC on Monday in DC. By the way, they're all being asked to be in office 5 days a week right now, which is new. The thing that's very palatable is that they want to be smart on the space. They want to be constructive. They want to make it possible for things to happen. They want to things can't happen overnight for a variety of reasons. But I'm really optimistic about what we're seeing there. So count me as an optimist relative to the last 7 years, at least in the current
That's
moment. Of
great.
course, it's
And
all
perfect
TBD.
CEO answer. Perfect CEO answer with the well done. Right?
Thank you. Thank
Beautiful.
you.
Beautiful.
Thanks.
You
Good. No,
navigated
it's a
that.
good, that's a good
No,
measure to
you,
take for sure.
yeah.
Cause most
No.
people are just there, they're humans, they're there to do a
Yeah.
job. And like I think that was very well put.
Yeah. There are
Exactly.
politicians, certainly, there's Elizabeth Warren and others who are there to influence the world, and they have a view on what everyone should be doing. But the 13 people in the meeting on Monday, they're not politicians. They didn't have a platform. They applied for a job. They got a job, or they were recruited to a job, and they want to do a good job, and so on and so forth. So that's just always, I think, a thing. I remember we filed for a Bitcoin ETF maybe in 2018, which is now
approximately 100 years ago. And we've been rejected many times before ultimately being approved last year. And I think in 2019, we got the rejection letter, and it was like 130 pages
Oof.
and or something like that. I remember thinking to myself, like, damn, you could have made it four, just said NFW, or absolutely not. But this is very long and robust. And I also was thinking to myself, I mean, I don't know about the two of you, but I haven't written 100 pages in
No.
forever. I don't even know if I wrote 100 pages in college. Like, writing 100
Exactly.
pages is a serious endeavor.
Yeah, and to even read like, an offering memorandum or something like that these days, or you're going through all this and oh my God, so to write it,
So then, and then I was thinking about these are just humans. I was like, wow, somebody sat down and wrote 130 pages to just say no. And I think at like a year or two later, somebody whispered to me that maybe there was an intern that was involved in doing that. And I just sort of chuckled, a tear rolled down my cheek. But and then I was like, oh, that makes sense because nobody wants to write 130 pages. So anyways, I think always with the regulators, one must, in addition to all of the other interpretations that are possible when you see things, one element of interpretation that everyone always has to sort of keep in mind is that these are indeed, it's just your neighbor, and they have a certain number of hours a week, and they've got other things going on, and they're trying to do a good job.
That's a great take, and something you could extrapolate to like many scenarios. And just a quick time out here to announce that we're rebranding of our trading Discord server to the Trading Syndicate, not only offering ES where JJ teaches and trades, but other futures, instruments, stocks, crypto. We have DFS and sports betting, which I'm highly active in. You can come visit us at thetradingsyndicate.org. So we got the passing of the Genius Act this last week or so. Just for, for the listeners, Hunter, can you just touch on the importance of this bill passing for the crypto industry?
Sure. Hugely important, specifically, and even more important from a meta perspective. The meta perspective is that Bitcoin has been around for 16 years, and for 16 years, it has been a space that people have felt had regulatory uncertainty and regulatory headwinds. A valid question for 16 years is, won't the government just shut this down one day? And that has been an omnipresent risk and concern and consideration for the entirety of the life of this category. And that ended this year. So, if you're thinking about risks, probably the number one and longest standing risk came off. The Genius Act is a manifestation of that. It's a component of that. It's, of course, indicative of the broader circumstances, which is that Congress, the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, vote the you know v majority voted to create a constructive regulatory, or sorry, legal framework to enable, specifically to enable and encourage the development of stablecoins in the U.S. That's one expression of it. The change amongst the regulators, the OCC, who's the bank regulator, maybe a month ago, put out a video on Twitter, saying that banks are welcome to launch crypto products and services without asking them. Here again, imagine an organization. There's a meeting. Should we change our policy, our stance on crypto? Discussions, work done. Yes. Okay, not only are we going to change our policy, but we really want people to know. What if we hired a professional videographer and had them come into the office and film us putting out a message about this change, and then we'll tweet it? So the extent to which that is a constructive and productive energy and desire inside of that organization is just remarkable. It's not even sort of like a clerical change. That you have to go dig up somewhere. It was a change they wanted to broadcast. They wanted everyone to know that the bank regulator says you can launch crypto products and services. So that's another manifestation of the change in the environment. So I think that the meta is that this has been the biggest risk for this space and challenge to adoption of this space, and it's been removed. And the Genius Act is an example of that. Specifically, the Genius Act pertains to stablecoins, and the TLDR is within 2 years, stablecoins will be everywhere, whether you know it or not. And it's now very rapidly going to be adopted. Maybe as an analogy, stablecoins are very much a technology story. If people can rewind their memories a little bit to when the iPhone came out, the iPhone, people were trying to make sense of it. It's sort of this toy, taking photos of your lunch. I had a BlackBerry. Maybe you guys had BlackBerries.
Oh,
And I was like, no keyboard. No keyboard. What, how am I gonna write emails? This thing is no keyboard.
exactly.
Seemed like a silly thing. And you fast forward 3 years, every corporate has a mobile app. And it just happened incredibly rapidly. I mean, nobody was tracking when is Best Buy going to launch the mobile app, when is, this firm and that firm, but everyone did it. And I think that's about to happen with stablecoins. Every firm that is involved in the movement of money, be it transaction processors, e-commerce, financial institutions, banks, they're either going to integrate with and be able to handle, receive, send. They're going to issue their own. They're going to be able to hold balances, and it's not going to happen slowly. It's going to happen fast. I think 24 months now that we have the Genius Act.
Wow. Wow, interesting. Yeah, the stablecoins, you guys at Bitwise have I believe I've seen, I think I've definitely seen like Jeff talk about the importance of the stablecoins. So like what use cases or clients like the do the stablecoins unlock?
The use cases are immense. So I'll give you one example that I've always found compelling. Starlink uses stablecoins to pay vendors across, I believe, over 100 different countries. And just from a treasury management and international working capital management perspective, that allows them to take one balance and use it to settle accounts payable in 100 countries, and to do it very expediently without worrying about FX, without having to set up 30 different correspondent banking relationships, to be able to do it in very small size, very cost efficiently. I may be off, it may not be 100, it may be 80, it may be 110, but that's one example. That's just a corporate finance, corporate treasury implementation. I believe that Shopify will now allow you to check out with stablecoins and make a purchase with stablecoins.
Wow.
I believe Stripe now has that capability as well. So I think you'll see more and more of that. I think that you'll soon see certain banking apps when you press the button to transfer money and it says ACH, check, wire, there's going to be another option. They may not call it stablecoin, but you're going to notice that that option seems to settle in 10 minutes and that you can do it on the weekend. And it doesn't come with a $20 fee. Maybe it'll have a $10 fee because it's a bank. But I think that those are some of the scenarios that you're going to witness it. It's ultimately a little bit like saying, what would be the use cases for ACH? It's a little bit hard to do a comprehensive rundown of every use case of ACH. I think a lot of it will just be, so what are the technology formats today for transferring money? There's cash as a technology format, there's checks, there's ACH, there's Fedwire, there's probably another one that I'm not recalling. People use all of them today, and you can get statistics on this. They just have slight benefits and trade-offs. So I think stablecoins are just going to get added to that list, and will absorb some amount of money flow where it's competitively advantaged. I think international operations are definitely going to be one of those scenarios. I suspect remittance will be a scenario. Micropayments will probably be a scenario. A lot of online e-commerce scenarios I could imagine being a scenario. The other thing that's very interesting in crypto always is that you guys may know this is sort of harkening back to when I was at Facebook, but when when Edison's and a few others at the turn of the 19th century, so 1890s into the early 1900s, was developing film and motion pictures and so on. The first things that were filmed were radio show hosts talking into a microphone and producing the radio show, and plays, where it was just a film of the play. And it took a while before you had movies. And movies were start with the format, and then so those two things were start with the content and then just record it in the new format. But movies, where you have cut scenes, you zoom into someone's face to see the tear roll down their cheek, or you're in front of the pork store, and then you cut to a scene in Liverpool or wherever else. That is the content being designed for the format versus the inverse. So I think always with new technologies, you start by putting the existing content onto the new technology. But then usually the more interesting thing is what is uniquely possible with the technology that wasn't possible previously. To give more examples of this, just to make people sort of visualize how prominent this trend is. YouTube is not, you can watch MTV music videos on YouTube, and you can watch The Tonight Show on YouTube, but much of what people want to watch on YouTube is stuff that did not exist on broadcast television. Might be Mr. Beast. It might be anything else. And so it was content that became uniquely possible because of YouTube. So there's tons of examples of this. So I think stablecoins will apply some efficiency to existing use cases, but you will also start to see some of that new stuff. And I think I have one other iteration of a take on stablecoins, if you guys have the
Please,
tolerance for
please. Oh, yeah,
another
please.
incredibly long-winded answer.
No.
There's a conversation about tokenizing securities that has been around forever. I think in 2017, people called it security tokens. Then it was token curated registries, tokenized securities, real world assets. There's been a whole host of instantiations for how people describe it, but there's always been this feeling that if a blockchain is a settlement ledger, why couldn't you be settling securities on a blockchain? I think always the question is, who is going to prefer that? Because all the people dealing in securities today already have ways of settling. Do either of you have trouble getting exposure to a money market fund? Is that
No,
like a
no.
huge pain point in your life? Or, are you having trouble buying NVIDIA?
No.
And certainly the financial advisor at Morgan Stanley doesn't have trouble buying a money market fund. So great, tokenizing the money market fund sounds in theory useful. Maybe it'll save some costs, but really, what is the win? So that's sort of an open question, and there's a lot of people who have an intuition that there's value there because the rail is so efficient. But there's this unanswered question about, okay, for whom is this 10 times better? The most common working answer is that it is somebody in Tanzania who doesn't have access to NVIDIA through the set of accounts that they have or don't have. And I think that's valid. And I think Kraken just launched StockX, which is tokenizing equities, and they launched it for markets that are not the US or Europe, where that is true. And I think that it looks like it's having success so far. Let me try to bring these two topics together. If I said, Ray, JJ, Bitwise has this amazing new ETF. The ticker is OWNB, as in own Bitcoin, and it holds an index of the largest Bitcoin treasury companies. And you go, that sounds like an exposure I want. So you write down OWNB and you say, I'm going to go buy some of that ETF. The way that you're going to choose which brokerage account of yours to buy it in is probably not going to be whether Interactive Brokers or Merrill Edge or E-Trade or Schwab or Robinhood has better features. It's probably going to be the one where you have a balance,
True, very
where
true.
you have some cash. Or
Exactly.
we're okay. So just bear with me for one more minute. Stable coins are balances, and they're balances that live in MetaMask and Phantom and Coinbase Wallet. So suddenly, there are going to be more and more places that have balances of cash. And there might be somebody who made most of their money on crypto, and therefore they have a MetaMask account with a large balance, and that balance now includes cash because there are stable coins. And you say to them, there's this ETF, the ticker is OWNB, and they go, oh, I would love to own that. But most of their balance is in MetaMask. It's not in Schwab. They can't buy OWNB in MetaMask because it's a security, not a broker-dealer. I think that when you tokenize OWNB, then you maybe can buy it in MetaMask. And so I wonder if the other story on why tokenizing securities is going to have traction is going to be because you're going to suddenly have tons of funded accounts via stablecoins that are not broker-dealers. And
Exactly.
therefore, you're going to have to, everyone hates transferring assets between brokerage accounts.
Oh,
So if you have $100,000 of stablecoins in MetaMask and there's the tokenized OWNB sitting right there, then you're going to prefer to buy it there, and you're just going to
yeah.
prefer to buy the tokenized version because that's the only version that you can buy right there in your funded MetaMask account. And you'd much rather do that than try to figure out how to get your stablecoins into Schwab. I think that that is one of the I'll land the plane now, but I think that that is going to be one of the emergent byproducts of stablecoins, which is that things that you don't currently think of as brokerage accounts are going to have funded balances, and then if alongside it securities get tokenized, just a lot more things. You may have stablecoins in a wallet on Twitter in a year and a half, and then if we tokenize securities, you may wake up in 2 years and you're going to own shares of NVIDIA, tokenized shares of NVIDIA in your Twitter wallet, alongside stablecoins, and it's going to effectively be a brokerage account. That is a proposition for one of the emergent dimensions of stablecoins that I could imagine, and a way in which I think it could intersect with tokenization.
For sure.
That's
I
really cool.
think that last part makes the total, like, the most sense in the world. That would, like you said, like the pain of, like, if I already have it, like, I don't have to convert back to USD, go, like, it makes the whole process more seamless. I think that'd be huge. That would absolutely be huge.
And conversely, if you have a Interactive Brokers account or a Schwab account, like, you can already buy NVIDIA. You don't need tokenized NVIDIA. What is that doing for you? So that can't be the answer.
What about creation of product? I mean, like the IPO process. Okay. The lawyers, the accountants, audits, going through the SEC reviews, or even buying a trading shell or something like that and doing a reverse merger. What if you could float something, tokenize it? Think of the audience of retail is anybody with a Twitter wallet can buy this stock. I always think of a creator of product. I've done 200 IPOs.
Oh,
So,
wow.
yeah. So I'm always like, how can we get distribution, right? That's my thing. My whole thing is distribution. This is just like, it's like going through a time portal into a whole new world for old guys like me. Because, I'm looking at things like Hyperliquid and stuff like that, trying to figure out how those things work and the tokenization of that. I'm like, wow, as a creator of product, you could like do an IPO every day. It's that fast instead of waiting 2 years or 6 months or whatever it takes and going through all the flesh-eating lawyers and all that stuff.
So I think in terms of new assets, we have two ends of the spectrum. There's take NVIDIA equity and then wrap it and tokenize it. Then there's you just have a digital asset like Pengu, which is a meme coin effectively. Then in between, I think there's some interesting possibilities. The two dimensions of interesting possibility that I could imagine are you might be able to, if we'll have to see how certain things, both market market structure and regulatory requirements play out. But you could imagine a scenario in which the dividend for a shareholder who's held shares for more than 3 years is larger than the dividend for a shareholder who's only held for 3 months. Or I don't know. The right now, it's very hard to program in features on a per shareholder basis, but tokens would enable you to do that because you can target each specific wallet holder very efficiently, whereas the existing equity ecosystem has so many intermediaries that it's very hard for the issuer to ultimately make sure that something happens to a specific shareholder. So I think you could see innovations like that. The other end of the spectrum is what I might call, microcaps. There's probably a million businesses that make $10 million of revenue. There's just no world in which they're going public. It doesn't make sense for the underwriters. It doesn't make sense for them. But there may be a world in which if you have a favorite pub, or you have a maybe Pret A Manger in the UK, or Joe's Stone Crab in Florida, says, we would love for our most avid customers to have a vested interest in the business. We're not going to IPO the thing, but if there was a way that they could have a stake, and I can imagine that there may be a world in which that can be achieved through tokens, because public blockchains provide the market structure, with very low minimums, right? Like if there becomes a way that they can create a token, well, Uniswap means it's immediately traded, and then the wallets mean it's immediately available, and so the market structure becomes available to a much longer tail. One would have to figure out what that thing is, but I think that there's a lot of interesting possibilities in the middle here. And if you think again, go back to YouTube. This is the person who does unboxing reviews of new
Definitely.
consumer electronics, or it's just inventory that didn't exist on broadcast, where in this analogy, broadcast television I would think of is like mainstream book, underwriters, IPO roadshow, big board, Reg NMS exchange, go talk to the hedge funds. So I think you could start to see inventory like that become enabled by this more democratized platform.
It's gonna be so fascinating to see
It
how this
is.
all evolves. So it's a exciting future. Just as an aside, man, it blows my mind how much those like unboxing views get. Like even my son, when he was younger, he would watch the unboxing of toys, and I'm like, I'll go like see what he's watching. I'm like, what, 5 million views, and the guy's opening like a
Really?
little toy this big. I'm like,
Wow.
what the hell? I don't know. I can't wrap my mind
It's
around that, but.
amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing. What that paradigm suggests is that if you lower the barrier to entry and you broaden the distribution, we're probably going to discover a lot of things, like on YouTube. Just broad no broadcast TV producer ever figured out that they should be running a show where people unbox things, but it was figured out in the democratized form of YouTube. So I think we may see that happen with asset ownership.
It's gonna be neat. The first podcast we had, Hunter, one of the things I really like you said, because I wasn't thinking of Bitcoin in this manner. And maybe it relates to all the crypto, but we were talking Bitcoin specifically on like the spheres, like the three spheres that like overlap, and like people like Bitcoin for different reasons. And it's like you have the tech, you have like the ideology, like, and then you have the finance aspect. I thought that's like really cool. On the discussion of stablecoins, because I think like I've heard, maybe this is probably people in like the ideology camp of it, that they maybe argue that stablecoins are fiat and crypto clothing, centralized, relying on trust of the issuer. Do you view it as like, well, I guess you could just like answer that, and then also like, did you kind of like look at it as, I guess maybe concessions need to be made, or not concessions, but like for us to really hit, massive adoption or like world impact, like these things actually need to happen?
I think for somebody who's worried about dollar debasement, who's worried about reckless monetary policy, who's worried about censorship or seizure, and various other potential impacts of government, it's just much more likely that Bitcoin is going to be the answer for that person. And so I think that there will continue to be movement to make Bitcoin more useful in transactions and payments. And Square, I believe, launched the ability to pay for things in Bitcoin. And there's a contemplation in Congress of a de minimis exemption where you don't have to pay tax if you use Bitcoin to pay for a transaction that's less than $500 or $600. So I think not everything will be solved and satisfied by any one dimension of the space. I think to your point there, Ray, which it seems salient to me, I think people are going to be who sort of are looking for the solution of I'm concerned about dollars and all of those elements of it. Stablecoins are not going to deliver that for them. I think stablecoins can be sometimes I've thought, we have over 5,000 wealth management firms that own our products and wealth teams and banks and broker-dealers. We just had a bank with over $1 trillion in AUM across their client base approve one of our products and
Wow.
sovereigns and endowments. And so we do a lot of work to try to help people build their thesis and understand the space. And I've sometimes thought that stablecoins is like the worst word to help somebody understand what stablecoins actually are. I think a better way of describing it is that it's transferring dollars over a blockchain. And if you describe it that way, then you can pretty quickly see that will transferring dollars over a blockchain resolve all of the concerns we have about dollars? No. Bitcoin might, but transferring dollars over a blockchain, aka stablecoins, is probably not going to. So I think that there is going to continue to have to be different initiatives.
Yeah, for sure. Do you with this Genius Act, it seems that this is like reinforcing trying to reinforce like dollar dominance, with stablecoins, requiring a one-to-one backing with US Treasuries. Do you think like the government's kind of like using this as like a Trojan horse strategy to extend like the US like influence through crypto rails?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. And I think that's part of what's helped Congress get behind it.
Yeah, for sure. All right, just a couple more things, Hunter. Get you on your way here. I guess stable while we're on the I was gonna ask you about like I don't know if you could even talk about it, like maybe some new product launches you guys got in the works. Specifically with stablecoins, I don't know if you guys actually have any I don't know if that's something to even build products around include.
Yeah,
Yep.
so there's a few things going on the product front. We're attempting to uplist the Bitwise 10 Crypto Index Fund, BITW, to convert to an ETF. That's one thing that's happening. On the stablecoin front, to some extent, we have an ETF. The ticker is BITQ. So BITQ is an ETF of publicly traded crypto companies. So for instance, it now has a large position in Circle. And Coinbase also makes revenue from stablecoins and has a large position in Coinbase. And as more companies participate in generating revenues from stablecoins, it's a strategy that helps people get exposure to that. Then setting aside the topic of stablecoins, we have a new suite of funds that generate income on exposures. So IMST is a Bitwise strategy ETF that writes calls, does call overwriting or call writing, cover call writing on MicroStrategy. And we have one for MicroStrategy, one for Coinbase, one for Marathon, one for GameStop. And they make distributions of the income generating from writing those calls. And I think we just published the distributions for June, and they're over 50% annualized distributions. So I'm excited about that area because I think when people think of crypto, they think of the price can appreciate a lot, and that is obviously a premise for a lot of investors. They also often think, okay, but I'm going to have to deal with this volatility. What fewer people think about is the fact that the volatility can actually be an asset to you.
Right.
If you, for instance, use covered call writing to monetize that volatility and eat it as income. So it's a strategy I've mentioned that we do for some very large clients through separate accounts where they already own Bitcoin or Ethereum. And these ETFs enable clients to participate in monetizing the volatility and turning the volatility into an asset rather than a concern. So I'm very excited about those as well.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I see Jeff. Jeff writes like very well about these things. Awesome stuff. Last thing I want to ask you, and I don't know if you know, talk to anyone about this or if there's anything going on here, but did you see any meaningful intersections between AI and crypto?
It's a long topic, Ray. I think that it's still in its conceptual stage. I'll try to rattle through a few quickly. The frontier of what people are contemplating with AI, the current version is you have ChatGPT and it's Google search. Maybe it's an assistant that can answer questions for you. The frontier that people are, I think, very excited about is agents, which is where you say, build me an itinerary for a trip, comes back with an itinerary, and then you say, make the reservations. And then it can go make the reservations. In the agent world, it can take actions on your behalf, not just produce information for you. But if a computer is taking actions on your behalf, you probably don't want it to have an uncapped ability to spend your money. So you might be a little nervous about saying, here's my credit card and the three-digit code on the back. Good luck. And then find out that something happened that you weren't expecting. What you might do instead is give it a balance of stable coins and say, here's your allowance. It's a few $1,000. Go get the things done that I've asked you to do. And you know the maximum risk that you have that it messes something up or makes an incremental decision you weren't anticipating. That's one dimension. Another dimension is when the Gutenberg Press was created, before that, it was very hard to get books published. You had to talk to the monks. And then an explosion in the ability to publish books and pamphlets started to get published and books and novels, fictional stories, and everything started to get published because there was now a means of production that made it much easier for people to be able to express their idea and then get it to people. So I think there's a lot of work in AI right now to enable people to make movies, motion pictures, to make videos, to record audio in someone's voice. I know there's a firm called Blockchain Co-Investors that has a podcast in the voices of the two partners, but it's completely computer generated. They never record it.
Wow.
So they've just trained it on their voices and it uses their turns of phrase and everything. So people are now using AI as media production, printing presses. The challenge is that it's so good at its job that you actually don't know what's real. And what happens when somebody publishes something in the iconic voices of Ray and JJ, and it's unauthorized, it's not you, you don't know who it is, what do you do? So I think that the challenge that's going to emerge is how do you verify authenticity? of things. That's going to mean you're going to need sort of a you're going to need I imagine a ledger, in which people can sign that this is an authentic piece of media, this is an authentic recording, this is an authentic artwork, this is an authentic whatever. But then people need to be able to check that it can't be the notary at City Hall, where you go get the birth certificate. It's got to be a much easier to access ledger. It's probably got to be digital. It's probably got to be checkable every second of every day, regardless of the day of the week. And it's probably got to be checkable by an API, by a computer, not by a human filling out a form. That sounds a lot like a blockchain. I think another point of intersection in a world where any image, audio, deepfake, you name it, can be created. How do we know which ones are the real ones and the non-real ones? I think a blockchain is a likely candidate for being the ledger. And then there's a third vector. Near is a protocol that is working on allowing people to build models and agents that just run on a blockchain. So they don't live on the private servers of OpenAI, but they live on a more trusted in a more trusted context. So I think all three of those are candidates for how we'll see these two trends emerge. But I think that they will converge on each other.
Very good. Awesome. And so that's going to conclude today's Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the episode, please rate and review it for us. If you guys like to join a supportive and professional community of traders, you can join us at tradingsyndicate.org. Hunter, tell the listeners where they can find you and anything else you want them to know.
I'm H Horsley on Twitter, and bitwiseinvestments.com is the site where we publish research and have information about products.
Right, awesome. So
Thank
for
you.
Hunter Horsley, I'm John Studd. He's the gorilla of House Street. You stop, so.